boxes at 25, 41. Well, things are so much different now. I'd say the situation's reversed, and it'll probably not be the last time I have to be out by the first. 25, 41, big windows to let in the sun. 25, 41, big windows to let in the sun.
Grant Hart wrapping up that set of music, short set of music, but still a great set of music, right? Right? 25-41 here on the Viva La Mock radio program. Tell you some stories about that song, or a story about that song. And that song is a breakup song, is it not? Is it not? Wow. It's this like really heartfelt breakup song, but it's not a relationship breakup traditional, because it's about the band breaking up. Yeah, it's about Husker Du. Yeah, Grant Hart was in Husker Du, if you didn't know that. So let's Grandpa's got to tell you about this. Grant Hart was in the band Husker Du. You should look up the Huskers and the Dews and learn more about that as well. But love that song. Song falls on the Mockster's like top, at least top 100 singles of all time, as far as songs go. Maybe not singles, but just songs. Top 100 songs. Another song in that top 100 is from that Junior Citizen album that the Poster Children put out back in the early 1990s. And He's My Star. Love that song. See, I play songs I love, and hopefully you will love them or embrace them or learn about them so that I can just pass a little something on to you. Anyway, we're wrapping up this radio program. We're wrapping up the hour. I got to remind you that don't forget on Saturdays from noon to 3, you can hear a little program we call Radio 9. Jay Thurber is your host. He does this mix of old songs and new songs, and then he like throws in some snark. He calls it snark. I call it funny. It's fun stuff. It's Radio 9 from noon to 3 here on your independent freeform radio station, 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh. Hey, don't forget, you can reach out to me and say, hey, Mockster, I got a song I want to hear on a future show, your next show. I'm like, what song is it? Well, I don't know. You've got to email me. WRCTRequest@gmail.com is the way to make that happen.
be concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards. WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Many things to talk about in this first portion of today's Friday show. First, I want to follow up on a story from earlier this week. Earlier this week, we talked about a former Fox News host, Bill O'Reilly, absolutely losing it at an airport, treating JetBlue employees terribly because their flight to Turks and Caicos was running very, very late. Well, the man who supports the party of personal responsibility and supports taking responsibility and holding people accountable for their actions, he says, really, this is Biden's problem. And it's because of Biden that he flipped out on a worker at the airport. As a reminder, let's start with the original clip. This is Bill O'Reilly at JetBlue in JFK Airport, threatening to get a worker fired and demanding his name and aggressively leaning towards the guy and all of it.
Season. It's Bill O'Reilly.
You got contact with
your
man?
Bill O'Reilly on Fox 5. He wants to see a manager.
No, what you're going to do. He's 3 hours late now.
Listen, flight delays suck. It's not the gate agent's fault, like I said. You don't treat people like this. And now he starts with the threatening for losing your job.
You're going to find out. You're looking at him.
You're going to lose your job. So anyway, that was the incident. And now we have an explanation from Bill O'Reilly, and he's blaming Biden. I don't know, guys, maybe there's something to it. Bill O'Reilly says it's Biden's fault. He threw a fit. And the statement is, on Tuesday, O'Reilly tweeted, "The character assassins on social media are completely lying about my interaction with the JetBlue guy who misled passengers during a 5-hour delay. I expected this." Speaking to Mediaite, O'Reilly acknowledged that he handled the situation poorly and could have used different words, but refused to apologize. He claimed numerous people recognized him and they started asking him about the holdup. He almost became like a union rep, guys. Oh, Bill O'Reilly was just speaking for the people. That's what was going on. He insisted the heat on him is a distraction from the real story, which is that JetBlue is subpar. The story is JetBlue can't get their flights off the ground. It was crazy in the terminal. For some reason, the Biden administration is not big on solving problems, and this is a huge problem. How this has to do with Joe Biden, I truly have no idea. And the story here, remember, there's two stories here. One story is they say they're all about personal responsibility. When they do something, when they choose to behave a certain way, and it's horrible and they get called out, they blame somebody else. And of course, secondly, it's they always insist in political discussions, you must state your principles. Give me your list of principles here. And one of the principles is personal responsibility. As soon as the principles are inconvenient, they ignore the principles. They abandon the principles. And that's the way it works. And as I said before, and I'll say it again, I have been so frustrated. Some of the most frustrating situations I can remember relate to airlines. Once, my flight was just canceled. There was no reason. Wait, but so is there a technical problem? No. Is there a weather problem? No. The flight has been canceled. Never an explanation. I lost a day, but we're rebooking you tomorrow. You want to start screaming at people, but you don't, because you realize it's not this person's fault. And my guess, when O'Reilly says that they were being misled, I know that feeling. It's very common when you fly that they say, folks, we have just, there's a light on that's on the plane and we want maintenance to look at it. It's just going to be 10 minutes until they get here. So we're going to hold off on boarding for now. Okay. Well, 10 minutes go by and they say, we're still waiting for maintenance. And finally, maintenance gets there. But they said it was 10 minutes for maintenance to get there. They didn't say anything else. They said, maintenance has identified a problem and we're going to look for a part here. And if we get it, it's only about an hour fix once we find the part. Okay. 45 minutes go by. We've not been able to find the part. It is an hour fix once we find the part, but this actually happened to me in Las Vegas. They said the closest part right now is in San Diego. We found the part and it's only an hour to install it, but it's coming in on a San Diego flight. That flight leaves San Diego in a half hour. Very short flight. But now you're doing math. You're going, okay, wait, so we're already 75 minutes delayed. The flight doesn't leave for 45. Then it takes 45 and then they got to get the part. And then it's another hour. And then blah, blah, blah. And then you get to, now, fortunately, this didn't happen to me. But then the classic is our crew has timed out. They now are mandated to rest, which I have no problem with. I mean, we want everybody to be rested. I don't want unrested crew and pilots flying. And then you lose a day. I mean, listen, I get it. These things are frustrating. You don't start treating people like crap. That's really the principle we should all be sticking to. Bill O'Reilly blaming everybody but himself. I have a clip for you today that is one of the most dangerous clips I can remember ever playing on this program. And the reason it's dangerous isn't because the person in the video, Candace Owens, is uniquely dangerous herself. There's, if you go on the New York subway platform, right, as I often do, you see unhinged people saying wacky things. They're yelling them. Sometimes they're yelling at no one, but they're not dangerous because no one's paying attention to them. If the crazy subway guy, I don't mean that Jared guy from Subway, the commercials, I mean the New York subway. If the crazy New York subway guy had a million people following them on social media and 150 or 200 or 300 people paying to hear them speak, we would say, wow, that subway guy is really dangerous. That's the case with Candace Owens. In this clip, now remember, Candace Owens falsely claimed that the comedian Bob Saget probably died from the COVID vaccine. He died from a hit to the head. Okay. Here she is saying she believes they intentionally killed people in hospitals during COVID. And people clap and people nod and people agree.
Well, I am a big believer that they intentionally killed people in hospitals during COVID. They wouldn't.
Now, who is they? OK, so let's pretend that these claims were subjected to actual standards. First is Candace. Who is they? Is it the nurses? Is it the doctors? Is it hospital administrators? Did some kind of covert government operatives infiltrate the hospital and sneak around and the nurses didn't notice? And who is they?
Let family members in there to make decisions for them. I personally saw when I went to an asthma clinic that they would not give me life-saving asthma treatment because breathing was not allowed, even though they had the nebulizer.
Breathing was not allowed. Candace, who didn't allow breathing? And how did you survive if you weren't allowed to breathe?
And if they had not sent an ambulance, I mean, I asthma attack is about like you've got a very short window of time. I was having an asthma attack and the doctor had the life-saving medicine and said that the CDC had barred them from giving it to me. So there was no question that they colluded to kill American citizens so that they could fluff numbers and say that people died of COVID. I still to this day question the use of ventilators. It makes entirely no sense. People needed oxygen, not compression on their chests when they're dealing with something that's in their chest.
Now, of course, a ventilator doesn't deprive you of oxygen.
So from top to bottom, yes, our government wanted people to die. There's no question.
Now, understand that there's often a conflict with a lot of these conspiracy theories. She says they were killing people to fluff up COVID death numbers. Others say the numbers are just bogus. The numbers are invented out of thin air. And of course, there's a conflict there, right? Because if the numbers are just invented out of thin air to make the death seem high, why would you need to go in and kill people in order for them to be really dead and reported as COVID deaths, because they're just making up the numbers. You don't need both. It's a conflict. It doesn't matter.
Because it fed the narrative.
Yeah, and
we're talking about crimes against humanity. People should face long prison sentences. People should face tribunals because of what they did.
Tribunals? What are you talking about?
During COVID. And not even that, the masking of children, the treatment of special needs kids that were being forced to be masked on planes, that were having, essentially the trauma that was put to people on a psychological level.
Right. She's now speaking to the emotional trauma. Yeah.
Should bring forth tribunals. People like Bill Gates and Dr. Fauci should be in prison. Rachel Walensky.
What crime did Bill Gates commit?
Among them, this was corruption top to bottom. And it was all done because they had already predestined the vaccine, right? They did deny treatment. They denied the use of hydroxychloroquine.
Now, remember, if this was subjected to actual rigor, we would say, what evidence do you have that hydroxychloroquine works for treating COVID? And she would either not know or she would say, I don't know, there's the 35-person study from France or whatever. And we would say, well, we have randomized controlled trials. We have really good, we have proper science, and it shows that it doesn't work. Now she says ivermectin.
Ivermectin.
Yeah. Same thing with ivermectin. What evidence do you have that ivermectin works for COVID? There is none. That is randomized controlled trials. They say it doesn't work. But it's diarrhea of dishonesty.
The media was complicit in it, and it infuriates me. It infuriates me the amount of people that were allowed to die and to suffer when there were medicines that worked because they knew that they could not get emergency use authorization if there was.
All right. So, you know, you hear stuff like this, and remember, people who believe this stuff sit on juries. I've told my story of when I had jury duty on my 21st birthday, and it was appalling. It was appalling that it was a simple self-defense assault case. And a third of the jury did not even understand the law. It wasn't about we disagree about the facts. It wasn't about we have different opinions about who's credible. A third of the jury didn't understand the law that was supposed to be adjudicated, used to adjudicate the facts of the case. So the people who believe, oh, the ventilators deprive you of oxygen, or they killed people. These people are on juries. They teach school. They might be your dentist. They might be your accountant. I don't know. But more critically, you know, if they're your dentist and you don't like them, you get a different dentist. You can't choose your jury. You only to some degree can choose your kid's teachers or whatever the case may be. These people are extraordinarily dangerous, and they have followers, and it's absolutely horrifying. I told you recently that it was a really bad launch for CNN Plus. CNN Plus is the streaming wing of CNN, under 10,000 viewers a day. The David Pakman Show is dramatically bigger than CNN Plus, and they spent, is it tens or is it hundreds of millions of dollars on it? It's crazy. And just like that, CNN Plus is shutting down, not even a month in. Warner Brothers Discovery is shutting down CNN Plus as of April 30, marking one of the company's first significant maneuvers since completing the merger of Warner Media and Discovery less than 2 weeks ago. This puts an end to CNN Plus. This decision is in line with WBD's broader direct-to-consumer strategy, said Chris Licht, the incoming CEO of CNN. In a complex streaming market, consumers want simplicity and an all-in service, which provides a better experience and more value than standalone offerings. I don't think that's the case. I talked about this on a stream. We, little old us and our colleagues in independent progressive media, we are not part of a network. We are not part of a coordinated marketing strategy. And yet we have plenty of both audience that is larger than CNN Plus and audience crossover. The fact that if people want to watch me and then Sam Cedar and then the Young Turks and that, you know, whatever else, right? You can find us on YouTube. We have YouTube channels, but, you know, our podcasts are in different places. We have all different schedules. When you call in is completely different. And people watch all of the shows. They don't need everything to be an all-in, all-in-one solution. And I think what the problem is that CNN Plus tried to capitalize generally on the growth of streaming which may no longer be growing. I mean, consider that Netflix saw a loss of subscribers for the first time in history. That we may be reaching saturation at this point in time. But CNN Plus wanted to jump in generally on the popularity of streaming. But they weren't bringing known content in the sense of like Netflix and Amazon Prime. At least you go, oh, here's 10 shows I love. I already love them. They're all there. With CNN Plus, it was original content on a platform that nobody had any emotional connection to. Not that everybody's emotional connection to me is so positive, right? We have a lot of haters. But the idea here is, well, people are in the audience because they want to hear from me, our team, us, our guests, the callers, the community. There was absolutely no community aspect to CNN Plus. The technology wasn't innovative or notable. It's just a dud. There's no other way to say it. And we'll see if some of these other services end up going the same way. It doesn't bring me pleasure, but it makes me reassured that it is not a clear, you know, everybody likes to have a hot take about what the future is. Early on, the legacy TV people were saying this streaming thing's not going to take off. Well, they were wrong. Then the streaming people said we're going to have indefinite growth and first mover advantage will prevent Netflix and Amazon Prime from ever having any issues. And growth started slowing down and competitors entered the market. And you've got Apple TV with Ben Stiller's great show and, you know, all these different things. And so actually, they were wrong, too. There's no one path forward. And I think the takeaways are flexibility, genuine content, and putting the connection with the audience ideally first, rather than saying, we're CNN, we'll just put a plus sign after it and people will want random shows. Our friend Rex Chapman, former NBA player, he had, I hope that I'm right, he had or might continue to have, I don't know. I saw some of what he was doing on CNN Plus. It's cool, but I already know Rex. And so that's the advantage. And everything about it was approached in a way that didn't really make sense. And it's over. It's already being shut down April 30th. And think of the money that was spent. And again, I've said this before. If we got a cash infusion that was just 5% of what was spent on CNN Plus, we 10x what we're doing. I mean, we take the content that we've developed over time, which we know has led to a decade of growth, right? We've never had a year where we shrink. Every year we grow more than a decade, 15 years. And we just dump that content in front of tons of people by buying Google ads and YouTube ads and Twitter ads and all this different stuff. We don't try to reinvent the wheel. We just say, let's put what we're already doing that works in front of more people. And it would have been money much better spent. Giving us 5% of what it cost to launch CNN Plus would have been a much better investment. Let me know your thoughts about the new streaming wars, the at least temporary decline of Netflix, the end of CNN Plus, all of it. Find me on Twitter at @dpacman. The David Pakman Show is, of course, a viewer and listener community supported program. We don't have a money tree. We don't have a coin plant in the backyard or anything like it. We depend on you. And you can sign up at joinpakman.com. You can also, if you have a membership already, you can now gift a membership to somebody else. There is a box that you will see that says, is this a gift? And if the answer is yes, you just check the box. If you don't know who to gift a membership to, don't worry. We have a list of nearly 700 people waiting for free memberships. You can also request a free membership at davidpakman.com/free-membership. Let's speak to some of these great people, members and non-members alike. We take calls on Fridays via Discord at davidpakman.com/discord. Let's go next to Alex from Baltimore. Alex, go ahead.
Hey, David, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Cool. I got a question about publicly funded elections.
Sure.
So I know it's a long shot in the United States, but so hypothetically, if one were to happen, how does the money get doled out? Because I know, you know, if it's a governor or president, technically there's like 8 independents and a bunch of other random parties no one's heard of.
Yep.
So do they get a share of the money, or is it, do they have to meet a certain qualification to get
this
that?
This is a great question. So listen, there's no one way to set this up, but you could establish. So what do we mean by public funding of elections? The idea is to limit the amount of money that can go into an election. And and I have to say, it's so loud where you are, Alex. Would it be okay if maybe I mute you to answer? Because this is a very important issue.
Hang on. Can you hear me better right now?
Yeah, I can hear you fine. It's just there's so much background noise. So the way we would set it up would be, we might say, okay, once you meet a certain signature threshold, then you qualify. And it can't be like 300 signatures, right? It really has to be significant so you don't have 100 people. Then you get X amount of money, you get X amount of local television time, and whatever. You could do it on a polling basis. You have to be polling at least X percent. Now, some people will say, well, the problem is you need money to get the polling and it. Okay, but so that's another way that it could be looked at. You also might have different thresholds depending on the population of the state or the race that you're running. So you wouldn't necessarily expect, a Senate candidate and a congressional candidate to have the same thresholds in terms of signatures, at least, because one is drawing from a much larger population base. So there's not one answer to the question, but it's a really important question that has to be crystal clear when you put these systems in place.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I figured that was the end. I also didn't know, is there any examples of other places that do it?
I don't have any offhand, to be perfectly frank.
Interesting.
Yeah, let me research that.
Can I do one more quick, I promise?
Sure.
What is your guilty pleasure foods? The thing that's just greasy and nasty and no nutritional value, but it's delicious and you tear it up every time.
Man, I don't know. Greasy and nasty. Well, I avoid foods I consider nasty, you know?
Well, I mean, like, looking, not tasting.
I don't know. You know,
like a,
I mean,
like
you
a
know
what? Cheese steak that's all spread out, you know, it looks a certain way.
But. Yeah, no, I'm not big on. I mean, I think, the Argentinian / Italian chicken dish Milanesa, which is a fried chicken cutlet, I am a big fan of. I guess that would be considered greasy, although I don't have it very often.
I guess I could also say, what about like a dessert, like something that's overly ridiculously sweet? And not
I'm a big tiramisu guy.
Mm,
yeah,
that's not a bad choice.
Yeah.
All right. That's all I had. Thanks for taking my call.
Alex, quick question. Would you agree that the top desserts are tiramisu, flan, chocolate lava cake, and pistachio baklava? Do you agree with that take?
You have a very Mediterranean take on desserts, don't you? I'm kind of a good old American boy when it comes to desserts.
Oh, please don't bring up apple pie. If you bring up apple pie, we're going to have to cut it off.
Let me meet you in the middle, then. How about a key lime pie?
Okay. That's less obvious, overtly offensive.
I'm more of a tart sweet guy, so it's things like apple pie, lemon meringue, that kind of stuff.
All right. Well, we'll agree to disagree, my friend. Thank you.
Yes, very respectfully, of course. Right.
See, people can have differences of opinion and still communicate in a respectful way. Let's go to Roylan from Grand Rapids. Roylan, you're on the air.
David, nice to hear from you, man.
It's nice to hear from you. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. So I had a question about modern monetary theory.
Sure.
So I don't know if you knew, last year, John Yarmuth, the representative from Kentucky, was on C-SPAN kind of touting modern monetary theory and, you know, accepting it as like a lens and framework to view kind of like the government and how it spends.
Sure.
So I was curious, do you think that MMT will like kind of become more prominent and more mainstream? Obviously mainstream is kind of hard to choose, but you know, more of a prominent framework to view policymaking.
Here's the thing about modern monetary theory. A lot of people think about it like something that you enact. Like, okay, we've turned on modern monetary theory. Now there's modern monetary. It's not really, it's really a perspective, right? The idea of the fundamental idea of modern monetary theory is that currency need not be restricted in order to prevent inflation in absolute terms, and that the creation of new money by governments has varied effect depending on what the money is spent on. And if you spend the created money, because we're talking about ones and zeros at this point, if you spend or allocate the created money in certain ways, it can be economically stimulative, whereas allocating that money in other ways might cause inflation. So it's not something where it's like we're now doing modern monetary theory. It's really just a framework where we would think about government spending in a different way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I agree. I think the issue right now is kind of because something like the Clinton years where we were in, I think, a deficit, I forget what they call it, a deficit or some kind, where there was less money in the economy. Trying to get away from that framework, because obviously we love the Clinton years, but we shouldn't be really having our balance sheet in that direction where there's less money in the actual economy. So I feel like the Democrats in particular would have to reframe their arguments on modern monetary theory. But as Stephanie Kelton has said with in her recent interviews that I've seen, actually, I'm not sure how recent they are, but she's actually talking to like Senate or to budget committee members and everything. So it's like they understand it, but I almost feel like they're trying to figure out how to reveal it to the general public.
Yeah, I mean, I just the concept can be boiled down pretty simply, which is like government spending doesn't just diminish the value of the dollar and cause inflation. We need to actually look at what the money is being spent on, and it can actually have economically stimulative effects. I mean, it's sort of like taking elements of demand side economics and adding more of a fiscal policy currency aspect to it. I don't know the best way to communicate it, but I do think that because elements of it are correct, it will hopefully become more of a part of the discussion going forward, is my hope.
Yeah, my hope is that for too, because when you read articles about modern monetary on just wherever websites, they're always saying like, oh, this is what we tried for the stimulus package and look, it's not working. Well, the thing is, like, did they actually discuss any of these policies with any modern monetary theorists about, you know, controlling inflation and unemployment and all that? The answer is no. They just didn't consider any of that.
Yeah.
So,
well, very good point. Yeah. I appreciate the call.
Yeah, definitely. And if you can just have some more MMT people interviewed, that would be great for it to become in more public.
Yeah, we've had Stephanie Kelton on twice. And am I right that Pavlina Cherneva also is an expert on MMT? I'm trying to remember. I think she might be.
I am unaware. My guys would be like Rohan Gray and Warren Mosler, obviously, and Randall Ray. Those are the main three guys that I listen to. But
all right. We will look into it. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you so much. You have a great rest of your day.
You too. There is Roylin with a beautiful phone call. Let's go to Pablo from Albuquerque, New Mexico. I've never been to New Mexico, Pablo.
Hi, David. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
All right, great. I'm not sure I really have a question. It's more a while back you had asked why we should keep on bringing up about the deaths of like right-wing conservatives. And it's sort of touching on that.
Wait, hold on a second. I asked, why should we bring up the deaths of conservatives?
Yes, in regards to COVID deaths.
Okay.
Pretty much like when all these...
Let me see if I can understand. So you're saying sometimes an anti-vaccine right winger gets COVID and dies. And,
yes,
and I said part of the reason to bring it up is that it exposes the incredible hypocrisy and also futility of their perspective when they confidently say no one needs to be vaccinated and then they die. And hopefully it'll encourage other people to get themselves vaccinated. Is that more or less what you're talking about?
Yeah, more or less. And the reason why I think is... as you said, you have to, they're confronted with, oh, well, you know, this, everybody was saying, people on the right, conservatives were saying, oh, you don't need a vaccine. Look, you'll be fine. You don't have to wear a mask, especially with the mask, being a mandate, not being required on planes. It does confront them with their own, sort of beliefs. Actually, there's somebody that Joe Rogan interviewed on his podcast, Megan Phelps Rogers, who is
Megan
actually
Phelps Roper.
Roper, yes.
Yeah, I've interviewed her as well.
Okay. I hadn't seen that one. I was actually curious about that. But yes, and you know, she mentioned how exactly being part of the Westboro Baptist Church, she had there's somebody that kept on confronting her about all these ideas yep. that she had. And it was a lot harder for her to, once she was politely confronted with all these different ideas, she sort of had to come to grips with that a lot of it didn't make sense to herself.
Yes. Absolutely well said. Thank you, Pablo.
All right. Thank you, David.
All right. Yes, let's confront people politely when they have incorrect ideas. Let's take a very quick break. We are going to take more calls in a moment. So don't hang up if you're hanging on to talk to me. Let's go back to the phones via Discord at davidpakman.com/discord. Let's go next to Eric from Cancun. Eric, welcome back. Eric from Cancun, you're on the air if you can get your audio working. And last chance for Eric from Cancun, plagued with corrosive technical difficulties. All right. No Eric from Cancun today. Not a problem. Let's go next to Cody from San Diego. How is San Diego? I was there not long ago. Love the weather. Great restaurants.
Hey, David, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
It's pretty great down here in San Diego, you know.
Good.
pretty good weather. I didn't, I kind of had just a scenario I wanted to comment on. It's kind of like just accepting, just being a doomer and accepting that Republicans very well may win in 2022 and
yep.
looking forward to 2024 if likely scenarios keep on happening and they win then as well. What do you think the climate looks like? I mean, back in 2016, kind of the narrative around that I was hearing back then was whether Trump or Hillary wins, it's kind of like not necessarily going to affect the daily lives of the middle class. Like we kind of see some of the repercussions now. Do you think it's going to be like very like incremental repercussions type of thing, or is it going to be kind of drastic swing changes that we'll see take place right away if a scenario like that would happen? Just wanted to.
I don't know that I understand. You're saying if Republicans take the House and Senate in the midterms, how radical will the change be? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. In the midterms, and then also, if that compounds into them taking the White House in 2024.
2024 is too far away to say because that's a few layers away.
Sure.
Here's the things that will change very quickly if Republicans take the House and Senate in November. First of all, no bills are getting passed. So, you know, Biden did infrastructure. He did a COVID stimulus bill. You know, there's a number of different bills that were passed. Nothing is going to get done. Nothing. It just there will be nothing done for 2 years, except, you know, if there is the most dire emergency where Congress absolutely has to do something, they're going to do it. But it will basically be 2 years of obstructing Joe Biden in an even more overt way than is being done right now. Number two, yes, probably there will be House investigations into Joe Biden and Hunter Biden, and they may even impeach him. And they will very quickly make the United States a joke again, the way it was under Donald Trump. So I think that, you know, when we say, well, the middle class won't really be directly affected. I guess that remains to be seen. But yeah. The reputation of the United States will very quickly go into the toilet again as a laughingstock. So it remains to be seen how quickly they will do these things, but they will do them. And unfortunately, I do think they're going to win in the fall.
Yeah. And that's the scenario I see as well. But just to kind of compound on your point, what do you think the tangible, repercussions of a Joe Biden impeachment would be?
Well, I don't think it would remove him. I think it would just be, remember, the impeachment is what the House does, and then the Senate would either convict or acquit. I don't think that he would get convicted because he didn't do anything wrong. And so that's a factor. Even with Republicans having a slight majority in the Senate, I don't think that Joe Biden gets convicted on impeachment. I think it will just become a charade. It will become a distraction, and it will just build the humiliation of the United States globally.
Yeah, well, I appreciate your comments. Thanks.
All right, Cody from San Diego, thank you. Keep enjoying the good weather there. Let's go next to let's go to Itai from Copenhagen, Denmark.
Hi, David. It's good to be on.
It's a pleasure to have you.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, what are the odds that given the Democratic presidential candidate in 2024 wins the Electoral College and the Republican candidate refuses to concede, that the Republican-controlled Congress will overturn the election and make said Republican candidate the next president of the U.S.?
So that's a really good question. So let me restate the scenario so people understand it. Some Democratic candidate wins the 2024 presidential election. Maybe it's Biden, maybe it's someone else. They win. They get more electoral votes. They are supposed to be the next president. However, Republicans, let's imagine, control both the House and the Senate. Could they successfully prevent the winner from becoming the president of the United States? My instinct, Itai, is to say no. It wouldn't happen. They don't really have the power. They tried to take that power. Some of them did in 2020. They don't really have the power. So there's no way in hell that they prevent the Democratic winner from becoming the president. That's my instinct. But then I think about, well, hold on a second. Even in 2020, they weren't close, but they were close to making it tough. And so if they were in full control, what would happen? And then I start to get a little bit scared.
Let's hope the former case is true.
Let's.
I also wanted to ask you, what topic would you like to be taught in public school that would make the American public more politically aware and engaged?
Critical thinking and media literacy.
Ah, that's good. I would have picked a course on political ideologies, so people at least know what the different terms actually mean.
Yeah, I see that as only really being useful if everybody already is educated in critical thinking and media literacy. I see those as prior steps to jumping into political ideology, but I don't disagree with you.
I see. Yeah. I also wanted to suggest that you should cover less the hate mail that you get, be it chats and from voicemails. It's because we already know that you are getting it. But,
okay.
It's a given. I would suggest, unless it's constructive criticism, to just ignore it because it's not worth your time.
So listen, I understand that. We do on Fridays in the last segment, we do 10 minutes of emails, and usually there's like two that are negative. So it's like 10 minutes on one show a week, and it's only one or two of those minutes. So I understand the opinion. It's a really small part of what we do.
Oh, I see. Yeah. That was me. Here in Denmark, just so your audience knows, the COVID pandemic is soon over. There are still some cases, but we don't wear masks or anything.
Okay, yeah, there's really no masks in the U.S. either. Hey, real quick, can you very slowly pronounce Copenhagen the way you do in Denmark? Because I struggle to understand how you guys pronounce it. Can you say it once slowly for me?
In Danish or English?
In Danish.
Copenhagen. It's because the U is a sound that doesn't exist in English.
Okay, and say it one more time slowly for me.
Copenhagen.
Okay. Wow. So the G really disappears.
Yeah, it does.
It does.
It's more of a V sound.
Got it.
In Danish.
All right. Very good. Thank you. I appreciate the call.
Thank you, David. And have a nice day.
You too. There's Itai from Copenhagen is the way I say it. Okay. Let's go next. Where are we going next? It's hard to know, because the phone calls are so widespread. Let's try going to Southcat. Southcat, you're on the air.
Oh,
Southcat.
Oh my goodness! Hello, David. How?
Oh, are you Scottish?
No, Australian.
Oh, Australian. Yes. Oh, okay. Sorry, I misheard your accent initially. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Yeah, a lot of people probably expect me to sound like Crocodile Dundee with a shrimp on the Barbie, but no. Well, thanks for taking my call. I was having a chat to somebody recently about. Well, his thoughts were that the Build Back Better plan had an effect on inflation, like a market of what, from what I believe, quite a bit of an effect on inflation. And I thought, I didn't necessarily agree with that, but what are your thoughts?
No, I don't think so. Inflation inflation predates the infrastructure package passed by Joe Biden, and it also is global, including, you know, affecting countries that have nothing to do with American infrastructure spending. So I've seen no evidence that that is the case.
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate it. Hopefully he might be listening. And just another thing, I just wanted to say I really appreciate the forensic nature in which you comment on words, the rhetoric that people in the media, whoever they are, over a broad spectrum, it's really important. Words matter, you know.
I appreciate that very much.
You're really good at it.
So, Southcat, thank you. Listen, is it like 1:30 in the morning in Australia right now? What time is it there?
It's 2:40. I'm doing a bit of work.
It's the middle of the night. Is it the middle of the night?
Yeah, it's actually it is. No, 2:40 a.m.
Right.
Yeah. Bit of a night owl when I have to get a lot of work done, so and one more thing. Just one quickly. I also appreciate you mentioning the situation with healthcare, especially with, I saw that, I think it's Kentucky, have banned abortion.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if it's Kentucky. This is disturbing. I really feel bad about it. Hopefully things will get better. Yeah.
All right, Southcat, you've said it all. Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you, David. Thank you very much. Keep up the good work.
My pleasure. Thank you. There is Southcat from Australia, the middle of the night, the witching hour, as some might call it. All right, let's go to Isaiah from Arkansas. Isaiah, welcome back to the show.
Hey, David. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hey, so I just have a little question that I'll have to explain a little bit, but the question is, do you think that it's actually possible for politicians to represent the will of the people? And kind of what I mean by that is, as just one example, in Ireland right now, the same poll, you have a majority of people that say, we want to join NATO.
Yep.
And in the same poll, same group, a majority of people oppose abandoning neutrality. It's a fundamentally contradictory idea.
Yeah. So your question is actually a different one. This is interesting. You're asking the question as, can politicians really represent their constituents? But the real question is, can politicians actually know what their constituents want? That's fundamentally the question asking.
That's kind of what I meant. Like, let's say I'm running for office and I'm not, I'm way too young for that. Sure. But, you know, I am not particularly informed about an issue, trying to learn, trying to figure out, like, hey, what do the people in my state want?
Right.
When you have contradictory ideas.
I think that this is a solvable problem. Now, I understand how if you join NATO, you're no longer neutral. So how could you want both to be neutral and to join NATO? That's a really specific example. Let me argue that for the most important domestic issues, it's much easier to understand what your constituents want. And so I do think that that's a solvable problem. But I agree that with something like foreign policy, particularly because a lot of people don't know what's going on, it can be hard to ascertain what people actually want you to do. That's fair. But I think with the bulk of issues, we can get pretty good data about what people want.
Yeah. Well, like to tie it to like a domestic issue, which I was trying to stay away from, but like with universal health care,
right,
a majority of Americans polled say they support universal health care, which I do as well.
Mm-hmm.
But a majority of Americans also oppose paying for health care through taxes.
Right. Yeah, so that's a conflict. And that one is very complex because you can even ask that second question about taxes in different ways and get dramatically different answers. So it's not even as it's actually even more complicated than you're pointing out. But point taken, you're raising an important issue.
Yeah. And I have two little side things. One, I'm actually wanted your opinion on this. Going to Florence and Rome in Italy in a few weeks.
Okay.
For a class of mine, I was wondering if you have we'll kind of be going all around the city. Have you been to either of those two cities, and are there special food items you would encourage me to try?
Well, I've never been to Florence, but I have been to Rome. I mean, honestly, just stay away from the tourist traps. If they have like mm-hmm. multicolored menus in 8 languages and someone's suggesting you eat there, don't go there. But there's so many great, great places in there's one place that's basically known for cod fritters. In Rome, I forget the name of it. I think it's like Filetto di Bacalao or something like that. I would absolutely go there. There's a place called Macaroni. It's kind of like sounds like the word macaroni in English. And it's also another great little spot. I mean, it's just stay away from the tourist traps. You really can't go wrong in Rome.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. And before you let me go, I just want to say I really, really appreciate you among all the leftist broader, however you define yourself, political punditry, and just how honest you've been with specifically things in regards to Ukraine.
Mm.
I've been very, very disillusioned with a lot of the left and a lot of creators I formerly respected, and in retrospect have had to go look back at their content, and it's really... It's really, really disillusioned me with a lot of stuff. So I really appreciate your coverage of it and your honesty.
All right, Isaiah, I appreciate the compliments. I am going to let you go and hope to hear from you again soon and enjoy Italy. That's going to do it for today. We will take calls again. We'll take a quick break and be right back. My friends, it is time for the Friday mailbag. You can email info@davidpakman.com if you have something you'd like to say. Sometimes tweets or YouTube comments or Instagram comments may be included as well. Don't abuse info@davidpakman.com. It's not good for you and it's not good for me either. Let's just jump in with the first message. This one is from Charles. Charles is writing about the Hunter Biden laptop. And Charles says, well, since the laptop has been deemed real, why don't you look into it and then say it's not a big deal? I almost feel bad for the Cuckman. I think that's me. He goes through his whole life thinking he is intellectually capable. David Pakman is the Cuckman. He makes his wife's boyfriend a Sammy after he slays her and thanks her for the opportunity to watch. Him and Will Smith should hand out. They can be a good support system for each other. Both are cucks. Both of their wives have public relations with others. This is the level of people who want to decide who else is intellectually capable. Now, as we've said before, we've talked about the Hunter Biden laptop story. The story is filled with misinformation and also has nothing to do with Joe Biden. So to the extent that the story is a media story, we've talked about it, but that's about as far as I'm interested in going with the Hunter Biden laptop. Polar wrote in and said, when most people look at David Pakman, they just see a dude. When conservatives look at David Pakman, they somehow detect foreign-born, Jewish, East Coast urban dweller, and most offensively of all, not at all an outrage-crazed maniac. Yeah, I'll talk with other hosts of shows like mine, and we'll talk about kind of like the tone and tenor of the hate mail and the antagonistic comments that we get. And everybody else says to me, they are regularly shocked by the focus on Judaism in the messages that I get. It'd be interesting to talk. Sam Cedar, I don't want to speak out of turn, but Sam has at least suggested that he doesn't get nearly as much anti-Semitic stuff as I do, even though Sam is Jewish. And I don't know what that's about. But in speaking with like Cenk Uygur from the Young Turks, we've talked about it also. You know, he gets stuff based on him being, quote, Muslim or Turkish. And I get a lot of anti-Semitic stuff and a lot of go back to Mexico, go back to Venezuela stuff, even though I'm from Argentina. That's another thing. And yeah, it's not only about stereotypes. It's also about ignorance as to whom do those stereotypes even apply. Like, I'm from Argentina. Why would I go back to Venezuela? I've never even been there. Next message is from Rhonda. Rhonda says, yeah, Dave, speaking of which, yeah, David, you do look like maybe you are Jewish. I know several Latins that are fair skinned and look Jewish. Well, thank you, Rhonda, for defending that I could be both Hispanic and Jewish. No, a lot of people don't know that Argentina is a very white country. It's not, I'm not giving my opinion of whether that's good or bad. You know, there's lots of white supremacists who ended up Nazi types who ended up in Argentina after World War II, and a lot of Jewish refugees who ended up in Argentina. I'm just saying there's a lot of what we would consider white people in Argentina. That's a fact, not an opinion. But thank you, Rhonda. All right, into some more substantive stuff. John says, David, have you thought about adding a co-host to your show? Don't get me wrong. I love your show and enjoy listening to it just like it is. And I also like the guest hosts when you're on vacation, like Farron and Jesse. But I like the Young Turks, too, because it's fun listening to multiple hosts bouncing ideas and opinions off each other on the topic being discussed. Just an idea. So here's the thing with this. You can always change your show to be more like a different show. And at one point in the past, we had not really co-hosts, but we would sometimes have, you know, like producers would weigh in or whatever. Not every show can be the same. So this show doesn't have co-hosts, and that's what this show is. If people only like shows with co-hosts, those shows exist. But my view is not every show has to be the same. So this show is, it's just me giving my thoughts, and we have callers and we have other things. There are other shows with co-hosts and no audience participation. There are also shows that do a little bit of both. Every show is different. There's a show out there for everyone, but this is how our show is set up for the time being. Nicholas wrote in about the RNC withdrawing from the Commission on Presidential Debate, something we talked about previously, as well as earlier this week. Nicholas said, hear me out. Have a debate that's just a Democrat and a third party. Imagine if you had Biden or some Democrat and Justin Amash debating and just left Republicans out of it. The RNC would be like, no, you weren't supposed to do that. And it would be amazing. Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot. And this even came up on our bonus show discussion earlier this week about Republicans seemingly bailing on presidential debates. The idea of Republicans is to delegitimize or delegitimate. Whoa, the presidential debates by saying they are biased and the Commission on Presidential Debates is partisan and we're just getting out. And they're imagining, of course, that that would leave only the Democratic nominee and that there would just be no debates whatsoever. It is true that if you had, you know, I've always said I want third parties to have more of a presence in American politics. If you had a stronger third party candidate or multiple candidates and the commission organized legitimate debates where you had the Democratic nominee as well as those third party candidates, it might make the RNC lose their mind. That's absolutely true. The risk, of course, is that because there's no Republican in the presidential debates, very few Republicans even watch it. You have a Democrat with a couple of third party candidates, and all it serves to do is to siphon off some voters from the Democratic candidate to those third party candidates. So I think it is not a strategy without risk. It would absolutely trigger Republicans to be left out, for sure. It might be to their benefit. And so I think it has to be thought through very carefully. Harb wrote in with an idea for a different 5-day work week. Now, we've been talking a lot about the 4-day work week. The 4-day work week, the idea is you have a 4-day work week and a 3-day weekend every week. You do a little bit of adjustment of hours, you do a little bit of adjustment of expectations, and you sort of like more or less get the same amount of work done in information type jobs, knowledge jobs. This doesn't work when it's about a retail store being open, as you would in a 5-day work week. Harb has a different idea, which is a 5-day work week, which is 3 days on, 2 days off. So the weekends move. And the idea would be you do 3 10-hour days and then you get 2 days off. And then you get another 3 10-hour days and then you get 2 days off. So the 2 days off shift throughout the week. It's a little complicated, but the idea is that you end up working a little more each year, but you also have more days off each year. And this will allow people to have both weekdays off and weekends off. I think it's really interesting and there's a lot of sense in it. And I've heard proposals like this before. The difficulty is it does become a nightmare for childcare. It becomes a nightmare for a lot of different things where you have to know, okay, if I'm making a doctor's appointment for 6 months in advance, is this the week where I have Wednesday and Thursday off? Or is this the week where I have Saturday and Sunday off? So there's a lot of complexities to it. That's not a reason not to do it, but it seems very difficult to imagine that the working world at large is going to be interested in such a proposal. But I find all of these things super interesting. Cher wrote in about Dr. Phil. Now, here I have to say I misspoke on the show last week. Okay. Cher wrote in and said, hey, David, it is incorrect to say Dr. Phil isn't a real doctor. Well, first of all, I didn't say that. Okay. But I'm going to read the email as is and then I'll issue my correction. It's incorrect that Dr. Phil isn't a real doctor. He has a BA in psychology. He got his master's in experimental psychology and a PhD in clinical psychology at North Texas State University. He stopped renewing his license in 2006. He is a retired doctor of psychology. So, I misremembered. Dr. Phil is a psychologist. He is not a medical doctor, and he does not have an active license. I wrongly said he was not a psychologist. I was wrong when I said that. The segment had nothing to do with Dr. Phil, fortunately. It was just sort of like an aside, but I misspoke. He has not renewed his license. He doesn't have an active license. Jose wrote in about Rumble, saying, hey, David, I wanted updates on why you haven't uploaded videos to Rumble recently. I think it's good to try and grow an audience where left-wing content is almost non-existent. Yeah, we continue putting up our content on Rumble, which is the right-wing video platform. There was about a 10-day period where Rumble wasn't publishing our videos. There was some kind of glitch. We didn't stop. They fixed it. Now, I don't know how much longer the Rumble experiment is going to go on. We only have like 1,000 subscribers there after a couple months. It doesn't seem there's a big appetite for left-wing content on Rumble. It doesn't really hurt us in any way to leave the content up, but we're thinking about, okay, we tried it and there's not much of an appetite. Maybe we'll leave the content up. Maybe we won't. Lastly today, Catherine wrote in about MyPillow. Catherine says, did you see the Consumer Reports ratings for MyPillow? The quality is mediocre at best. I think Consumer Reports really tried to be nice about it, but they are paid truth tellers. My mother bought a few about 7 years ago. She was addicted to TV sales pitches, and it was the worst pillow I ever tried to sleep on. The lumpiness was annoying and uncomfortable. It just didn't work for me. It was nothing more than chopped up foam. Personally, I love a good quality down pillow. Yeah. So two things. One, I have never owned any MyPillow products, but many of you have written in. Most of you say that they're not good. Every once in a while, I'll get an email from someone says, guys, I hate Mike Lindell as much as anybody. He's a loon, but the pillows are good. So conflicting reports, generally negative. I have stopped talking about down pillows on my show because every time I say I like a good down pillow.
Get started. I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Je sais que pour nombre de nos compatriotes,
I know that for many of our compatriots who chose the extreme right today,
la colère et les
their anger and disagreements which led them to vote for this project must also find a response.
Ce sera,
and that will be my responsibility and that of those around me.
French President Emmanuel Macron triumphs over far-right challenger Marine Le Pen, even as more than a quarter of French voters abstain. We'll go to Paris for reaction.
You have the far right that's really progressing, that's advancing. If you look at the score that the far right had in 2017 with Marine Le Pen, the margin of victory for Macron is much tighter than last time. And the other big factor here to look at is the level of participation, turnout reaching a very low level, its lowest level since 1969.
Then to Florida, where Republican governor and potential presidential hopeful Ron DeSantis has signed into law a gerrymandered congressional voting map that virtually guarantees Republicans four more seats in Congress while cutting the number of black Democrats elected.
And to Governor DeSantis, I'm not going to call what you're doing a culture war anymore. I'm going to call it just what it is. It's a racist tactic that you're doing, and you know what you're doing.
We'll speak with Democratic Florida State Senator Chevron Jones, a member of the state's legislative Black Caucus, and Florida's first openly gay state senator, about the attack on voting rights and how Florida's so-called Don't Say Gay law is part of a nationwide push by Republicans to score political points by attacking gay and transgender students. We'll go from Florida to Michigan to Missouri. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Emmanuel Macron has been reelected president of France, defeating his far-right challenger, Marine Le Pen. Macron won about 58% of the vote in Sunday's election. About 41% of voters backed Le Pen, an 8% increase over her vote count 5 years ago. Nearly 28% of French voters abstained. Many French voters oppose both candidates.
I won't be voting in this round, especially not for Macron. Not Macron because he's damaged the people too much and he only thinks about the rich. And in the second round, I'm not going to vote. I've come to do my shopping, and that's more important than voting for Macron or Le Pen. That's obvious.
We'll go to Paris on the French elections after headlines. U.S. Secretary of State Tony Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin traveled to Kyiv Sunday to meet with the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. They vowed to give Ukraine an additional $700 million in military aid. Blinken claimed Russia's failing in its principal war aims. Defense Secretary Austin said the United States wants to see Russia be weakened.
We want to see Russia weakened to the degree that it can't do the kinds of things that it has done in invading Ukraine. So it has already lost a lot of military capability and a lot of its troops, quite frankly. And we want to see them not have the capability to very quickly reproduce that capability.
During the trip, Secretary of State Blinken announced plans to gradually reopen the U.S. embassy in Ukraine. President Biden's expected to soon name Bridget Brink to be ambassador to Ukraine, a position that's been vacant since 2019. Brink is currently serving as ambassador to Slovakia, a post she began under Donald Trump. This comes as fighting continued in Ukraine over the weekend, despite calls for a truce to mark Orthodox Easter. In the Ukrainian port city of Odessa, at least 8 people died in a reported Russian military strike on an apartment building. Earlier today, Russia bombed 5 train stations in western Ukraine. Russia is also continuing to